From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in 2 weeks, primary day, June 22nd. For the last few weeks on this program, we've covered a number of races that voters will see on the ballot, including the race for Rochester City School Board. There are 9 candidates vying for 3 open commissioner seats. Our goal is to talk to all of them before you head to the polls. This is our 3rd conversation with school board candidates. We'll hear about their ideas for how to serve the district when it comes to dealing with budget deficits, student performances, the pandemic impact, graduation rates, and more. I'd like to welcome our guest now. Tatiana Welch is an educator and former teacher in the YMCA's enrichment program. Tatiana, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Hi.
And Josh Baroth is the county legislator for the 24th District. He's up against term limits there, running now for school board. He's an associate director at RIT, founding member of Parent Teacher Association at Montessori Academy School number 53. Josh, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, everyone. Happy to be here.
We always ask our guests who are running for office to introduce themselves to listeners and to explain a little bit about why they decided to run for this particular seat. I'll start with Tatiana. Go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tatiana. And a little bit about me. I am an educator. I'm a mother. I'm a humanitarian. I'm an activist. I'm a lover. I love kids. I love to read. I love to write. I have my undergraduate degree in... My associates are in liberal arts and psychology. My bachelor's are in psychology and English. And I'm currently in my master's program for my English master's. I love to write. I love to read. I love to teach. I like to help people succeed. I like to help people get ahead. I'm deciding to run because I have children in the district. And the things that I read about the district, the policies that's happening, things that they're supposed to do that they're not doing, are a problem with me. I'm a parent. I'm a mother. I'm being left out of things. I'm an educator. I'm being left out of things. Things of that nature. I see things. I've been in the school building. Things need to be changed. It's a destructive environment. It's a destructive system. I want to help those that are already doing their best to make it better, to also put my 2 cents in and help as well. Well, more than my 2 cents, because I'm going to give it my all. You know, this isn't a part-time job for me either, so it's a full-time, because this is who I am. I educate, and I just want to help those that are already in position to further succeed themselves so they can better succeed and help our children, because our children are the most important thing. They are our future, and without them, we have no future, you know, world. Our Rochester is slowly becoming just that, our school-to-prison pipeline altogether. It's just... We're getting all our schools are closed down when we have the funds to have them open. And I feel like it's detrimental to our kids to not be in school, to not get the education that they deserve. And I want to help them get the education and the skills that they deserve to succeed in our world outside of school and after school.
Okay. Josh, go ahead.
Thanks so much. I hate to start with this, but I have to correct you. I'm actually working at Nazareth College as a senior career coach. So
oh, my fault. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries. So my name's John Barth, and I am seeking, you know, the listeners' support for my race for the Board of Commissioners. And I've been in Rochester for a long time. We moved here in 2003, and we got involved very quickly. I joined my neighborhood association, and within 6 months, the president of the neighborhood association moved out of the school district because of the schools, and she didn't want to be with there for the kids. And so very early on, we were thrust into a role to say, okay, do we want to, you know, go to RCSD or not? And we decided to go to RCSD. I have 2 children in the district right now. They've been there since pre-K, and one's in 11th grade now, and one's in 7th grade. And they've done well, but they've had challenges. And we've done many, many, many PTA meetings, parent-teacher conferences, and the IEP planning meetings as well. And those are challenging. And I have, you know, the benefit of being relatively well-educated and well-spoken. And, you know, I have had challenges. I know people don't have time to go to the meetings in the middle of the day. I know families have challenges there, too. They are engaged, but they have difficulties engaging with, you know, the schools. And so Tatiana is right. Parents get left out a lot, and that's a challenge. So this is something that's really important to me. Beyond that, as a county legislature, I've actually been working in the school district in something they call a 3x3x3 committee, where we get together to talk about how can we collaborate? How can we share resources? And we've been trying to move forward to make sure that, you know, students who are attending schools are also attending city functions or getting resources from the county as well. And that's something, I mean, there's no collaboration except on an ad hoc level, and we're trying to make that better right now. On the county legislature, and this is something I think is really important to point out, I have a lot of experience with working with, really large and sneaky budgets. And I'm proud to say that I'm a bit, again, in the nitty-gritty. I'm a budget hawk. And I've done that with past administrations of DeNolfo and Maggie Brooks, but also, with Adam Bellow. I will look into it and say, what's this? What's going on here? Where'd this money go? And that's something I think I bring to the school board that isn't happening now. It's not easy. It certainly isn't, glamorous. But if you don't go line by line through that budget and ask pertinent questions and get pertinent answers, you don't know what's going on. And then finally, one thing you learn when you're in the minority, I'm a Democrat on the Republican-led legislature, and we've heard bad things from that, but you have to be like a duck. You have to let things slide down your back, and you don't take it personally. If you want to get something done, you have to be calm, professional, and willing to let others take the credit. And as a result, I'm one of the very few people who can claim passing local laws that have made effective changes to our ethics laws for the county, basically not accepting gifts from contractors. You'd think this would be a no-brainer, but it wasn't. I'm a straight shooter. I say what I think. I won't lie to people, and sometimes that means I won't agree with people, but that's okay. Some things I want to champion if I become a member of the school board is to help families who have students with special needs. They get left behind when things happen, when the pandemic occurred. It was people with special needs who got left behind in the dust because people weren't thinking about them when we were trying to react to the pandemic. I'm going to be a budget hawk. I'm going to make sure we're actually not wasting money. And you can do that. It just takes time to read through it. We need to recruit more BIPOC teachers. We need to do that both in the short term, but more importantly, in the long term. We need to establish a system where we have current RCSD students being subsidized to go to local colleges to learn to be teachers with a commitment to come back to the RCSD for a couple years. That's the long-term solution. And finally, to be honest, we really do need culturally relevant curriculum. And you got to cut me off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. And so there's a lot to work with there. Both of you referenced the fact that you are parents of kids who've been in the RCSD. Let me ask you both a little bit about that. What have you learned most, Tatiana, that you would take to the school board from your experience as a parent of kids who have been in this district?
Get to have people who understand our kids. When my son first started in the district, they thought he was autistic because he didn't speak for a minute, but he can read. He didn't speak to them, but he can read. And a teacher chastised him because he would rather have read in the corner than in the crowd. And I understand that because I'm not a crowd type of person. And so it bothered me that she hindered my son from reading what he wanted to read just because, that happened. I was that child in school, And as a parent, I want someone who cares and who can understand and who could encourage my son and make my son uncomfortable to be himself in front of him. So I thought he wasn't comfortable, so I moved him to ABC Head Start. And he flourished. He started talking immediately and just, in school and in public, So as a parent, I also see the lack of ability to provide. So when I mean to provide, the right level of learning to our children. So my son's constantly being told, you should be in this grade, you should be in that grade. No, he shouldn't be. He should be in the grade that he should be in. Just encourage him in the subjects he isn't doing good in. You guys are encouraging him so much in his spelling and in his science and things like that, but you're not encouraging him as much as I'm encouraging him in math. We both have to be on the same page. And so as a parent, I see that both on the teacher side and the parent side. Sometimes we're not on the same page. And that's a problem, and that's where we have to get parents involved more. And that's where accountability falls on not just the teacher, but also the student and the parent as well. And me and my son, we hold each other accountable for everything we do. That's his only job in life right now is keep his room clean and go to school. So the teacher's job is to educate my son as a supplement to me educating. The school system is just that, a system, so they are supposed to supplement at home. So as a parent, I see it both ways. So, that is exactly what I feel is missing.
Okay.
The lack of care and the lack of correct ability to teach our kids what they need to know.
Okay. Josh, what about you? What's been the most valuable experience for you as a parent that you would take to the school board?
Well, I think the most valuable experience as a parent is to recognize that, for most educators, they want to, be in the classroom. They want people to learn. They want students to do well. And they don't have much time to do it. And so I think that oftentimes, and I've had this experience sometimes, but not with everybody. It's mixed. you know, the best parent is a quiet parent, right? They're the ones not causing problems. Oh, the student's okay? Okay, great. We can just move on to the next thing. We need to have our parents not just be engaged. They are engaged. They're the ones helping students at home. They're the ones with their children. They're the ones who are really invested. But we have to have them engaged with us to be, you know, collaborators. And, I think that's very, very important. And we don't really encourage that. Think about it. Every time there's a budget vote, right, hundreds of people come to talk. They're passionate. They go to the school board. They want to have their views heard. They've come before. And then right after all this passion and all these interests, and, you know, they're not always agreeing, they do a school board vote immediately. And what does it tell us? It tells us that, you know, well, you can say what you want to say, but we're going to vote the way we're going to vote? That's a terrible message. So I think that we really need to make sure that parents not only are encouraged to participate, but are enabled to participate. I think, parents need to be involved in every aspect of the schools, not just for their, in the PTA where they're trying to, you know, work with the school-based planning teams that sometimes meet and sometimes don't meet, but also in the development of the curriculum itself, also in the development of how does, discipline get handed out? How is this done on a school-by-school basis? Because given the decentralization of how we work our curriculum, one curriculum in one school is not the same as in another school, we've got to have our parents engage on a school level, not so much, you know, just with their own children, because that's the part that they're going to do no matter what we say. But if they don't contribute their knowledge of what's happening to their students to the school has a much easier time just doing what they want to do because they think it's best. So I really think it's really important. The most important thing I've learned is you've got to do your best to be engaged, and not everyone can meet at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Some of us have jobs, and we have to do these things, and that's a challenge as well. So I think a parent engagement is something that is there for the taking. We just, as a school district, have not been willing to take it.
Talking to Josh and Tatiana about their thoughts as candidates for school board, and listeners, this is part of our series of conversations with the candidates, 9 candidates for 3 school board commissioner seats on the ballot 2 weeks from today. And a popular set of questions from listeners involves how the candidates viewed the district's actions in the last year in regards to the pandemic. In other words, was it right to keep the RCSD mostly remote when other local districts were back in with at least hybrid in-person learning opportunities? Do the candidates think that the Rochester Teachers Association was right to push for remote learning as long as it has, given the fact that RTA says they have surveyed their members, they're trying to understand teachers' fears and concerns about the pandemic, about safety, about ventilation systems in some buildings, et cetera. And then what happens in the fall? Is there a learning gap to deal with? And is there a set of safety procedures that is either sufficient or not in place yet that the candidates want to see? So there's a lot there, and we can take it in several different directions. I'll start with Josh. How did the district do in the last year with this, Josh?
Okay, that's a big question.
Yeah, it is. I know it is.
But let's be fair about it, though. This is in retrospect. We're looking at hindsight now. So, yes, mistakes were made, but, you know, it was a pandemic. No one knew what was going on for the first couple months. So I think there's some slack that needs to be given there. That being said, I think one of the things the school district doesn't have in place is a set of metrics or rubrics by which you can actually roll out changes. There was no way of rolling out a change. It had to be done on the fly, on the spot. So I think the initial, shutdown for the end of last year totally made sense to go remote because no one would really knew how bad this was going to be. And it was pretty bad. So that I'm okay with that. I respect that. But what I don't find acceptable is that decisions were made that everything was have a one-shot solution. Okay, we're all going to be either all hybrid, all remote, or all whatever. And that doesn't work for everybody. I think we went to a hybrid system too late. I think that we waited too long on that. I understand the hesitation, but in retrospect, we could have gone back earlier. And as a result, we do have, I don't want to call it a learning deficit. I mean, people learned a lot of different things, but let's call it a curricular deficit. They learned things that weren't necessarily in the curriculum. Like, we learned that it matters if everyone has broadband access or not. We learned, why some students might do better or worse in a remote environment, and some students did do better. But what we didn't really learn so much was how to make sure that unintended consequences weren't addressed. So, for example, one thing that really bothered me was that when we were talking about bringing back students for us, they were talking about providing services for students with special needs who are really having some challenges working remotely. And the solution was made, and they yelled it out proudly, that, oh, we're going to work with the city to use some of their rec centers for these students to socialize and work with individuals there. But what they didn't tell us was that, oh, you can only go from 11 to 12 for 1 hour, and you could only go if you didn't have any need for a helper to be with you. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you were just saying, you know, the district was saying, hey, we're going to do this for your students. And, in fact, quite a few parents were going, I can't use this. And it wasn't from malice. It was just an oversight. But these oversights happen when you don't have a system in place to actually say, okay, we need to make a change. How will we make this change? And that's really my greatest concern about how we did with the district, is that we just did a one-size-fit-all, just, you know, threw out a response and said, everyone would do this. And that's not hindsight. That's just a fact. My hindsight would be we should have gone to remote hybrid faster. But I respect the hesitation and fear the school board had at the time, if that makes sense.
Sure. Are you of the mindset, Josh, that there's going to be a learning gap that is going to be a real issue for the fall and for years to come based on what's happened in the last year?
Yes, absolutely. I think we're really going to see it, to be honest, not so much in the, you know, the pre-K first and second graders, but you're going to see it in the second, third, and fourth for the reading skills. I think that that's going to be a major concern because that's the foundation. It's where the district is weak anyhow, and I think it's something that we need to really consciously address. When we talk about, and I'm changing subjects just subject a little bit here, when we talk about what to do with stimulus, you know, the funding we're getting from the federal government, a lot of it should go towards, you know, short-term remediation or short-term support for reading and other things that may have gone left behind just because people weren't in person. So, yes, there is a deficit, but I think we can actually deal with most of it, or at least some of it, if we use our funding correctly. But that's only a short-term funding. Does that make sense?
Yep. And then the last point is just before I turn to Tatiana for her thoughts on these related issues, are you comfortable enough with where we seem to be going for the fall or where we may be going with districts reopening, primarily in-person learning, with some debate over whether even unvaccinated students need to mandatorily wear masks, things like that? So where do we need to be?
Well, I do think we need to go back in person. I think that we need to have some of the safety protocols in place that we have already in terms of, you know, cleaning rooms on a regular basis, all those other things. They made a difference. We've not had we've had a relatively small number of cases of COVID in the schools. I mean, not too many. Like, I couldn't give you an exact number, but not that much relative to the whole population. But what we haven't seen is colds, flu, pneumonia, all those things we typically see over the course of the winter, they all went away. The scientists are apparently now saying that, you know, there's a whole generation of the flu that it just didn't reproduce. And so we need to maintain that moving forward. In terms of masking, I'm willing to go with the CDC on that one. I don't know how many people are not going to be vaccinated, and that's partly because, you know, some of our, you know, kids, they can't get vaccinated yet. It's not legal for them to be vaccinated. And so I can't predict where that, if you understand, I just don't know what the situation, the layout is going to be at that time.
Sure. Okay. Tatiana, let's start with that sort of that broad lens on how the district handled the pandemic generally. What do you think?
I feel like they panicked. You know, that happens. You know, that happens. They're trying to pick themselves up from their bootstraps. I get that. I do feel that we should have started in-person learning right away. Our counterparts in the suburbs, most of their kids was in school 5 days a week, 4 days a week. Our kids didn't have that choice to go to school at all, which was hindrance. We were all trying to learn Zoom, the teachers and the students. Now, I'm saying this from a personal perspective because I did pods out of my home. When I first started, I started out with 8 children, and it was ridiculous. Half the time, the teacher was trying to get used to what was happening. The kids wasn't really paying attention. It was too much happening. It was neglectful to just throw us out there like that. It was neglectful to not think and bounce off of the other districts that's around us. I also was in the summer program with the YMCA this summer, so we had those protocols. We were following the protocols that was recommended for the schooling. Our kids had masks on in the building. Yes, it should be a choice to have that if you're not vaccinated. Yes, of course, wear your mask inside. If you're vaccinated, show proof you're vaccinated, so be it. But I do feel that the panic happens. That's to be expected. But we should have been back in school way sooner than we have been, in person, and hybrid as a choice for parents who were scared. but in person 4 days a week, because Wednesdays you gotta, you know, be clean. However, there are protocols in place that RCSB has that I think is great. We tried them out. We didn't try them out. We went through this through the YMCA program through the summer last year, and it was everyone. Yes, we had to suffer. It wasn't really suffering because it's for the kids. I don't call that suffering. It was mandatory that we did a little 30 extra minutes before and after, between classes and between time to, you know, switch around and clean the rooms. I love doing that part. I'm a clean freak anyway, so I'm fine with that. But I do feel that we should have been in school for 4 days a week at least, or if we did hybrid right away, we should have. I believe all grades are going to be suffering because of this pandemic and because of the lack of attention and the panic that the district had. However, I do feel that, like I said, it was a panic and emotions were there. They didn't know what to do. They were following government guidelines, things of that nature. As soon as the world started to open back up, our schools should have automatically went to hybrid, then got us into 4 days. I agree that the children with disabilities and special needs should have went first and have always, they should have never been left out. They should have always went to school full time. There are ways around it. There's a way around being particular. Just like we were doing at home, we do at school, we do these things. I was teaching these children how to be COVID safe, how to do these things, what to do, what not to do. It's about caring. So you also asked about what was RTA's right. How do I feel about RTA's right to push? I feel like half of the RTA, I don't want to say I know specifically because I haven't gotten all the way done reading that, but most of the people that's on the RTA don't work live in the city. So their kids were going to school full time. Our kids were not. We were here trying to learn Zoom and do things like that. I actually went out and tried to help parents learn Zoom. I had their students here, and we got work done. Half the time, I would have my kids stay on Zoom until 1:30, and then we just do the work. It was easier for me and the students to sit there and do the work, and we rotate through the classroom rather than them being on Zoom while the other kids are just doing whatever they're doing, trying to understand what's happening, while the teacher's trying to understand what happened. And they're in a group chat with the students trying to learn what's happening. And it wasn't their fault. It wasn't their fault at all. I used to commend my kids' students. All of my kids' students can tell you. I used to tell them, you guys are doing good. It's okay. I understand. You got this. Keep going. You know, because they need that too. And the parents needed that. And I used to say that to the kids too, like, y'all got this. And sometimes I'd get on and start entertaining the kids while the teachers were trying to figure things out, because it was a lot to happen. And no, I do not think they were right to push that. I understand they were scared. So were we. But I do not agree with that. And again, most of their kids were in school full-time or part-time right away, and they didn't bat an eye. Am I comfortable with where we are going into the fall? No, absolutely not. I am comfortable with the hopes and promises of Dr. Leslie Myers-Smalls of saying that we will be back in school full-time with the option of hybrid for parents that are, you know, still apprehensive. I'm absolutely okay with that, but I'm not okay with where our students will stand. Yes, our kindergartens all the way up to our 12th graders will suffer. I've only dealt with elementary kids at home, but personally, I still went out and personally went to their homes and helped high schoolers or middle schoolers. So yes, everyone is suffering. It's not just the high schoolers or the middle schoolers. Kindergartners as well, they didn't know what to do on the computers. All they know how to do is Roblox and play games and get on YouTube. My kindergartner, one of my kindergartners, when I got him, he was behind so far because the mom and the other parent in the house didn't understand how to even work the systems. And Seesaw was awkward. And when you're done with something, it goes back. And he had a lot of videos, things of that nature. We got him caught up, you know. And you have to understand these systems to work it. Not all parents knew it. Not all teachers knew it. So we were thrown out there. And I was uncomfortable with that. So I'm glad that we're getting back in there. I hope that we get more training on Zoom or get better things to handle and better people to come out, support, to be able to bring students work. I had a student that never had a book and was always getting yelled at or kicked out of class because this child didn't have a book that they was never delivered. I had all my students, teachers never, all they worked was delivered to my house or brought to their house with their parents. Some kids didn't have, some kids did. And I have a plethora of lessons and books myself, so we always did more things, but we were left out. Everyone was left out. Teachers, students, you know, administration was trying to get there and and didn't know what they were doing, and no one was there to help them. You know, no parents was involved to help them and tell them, hey, this is what's happening in my home. No students was there to say, no, this is not what's working. You know, again, I go, that gives me back to the students and parents being left out. We're being left out, and this is my platform. This is why I'm running, because we're being left out. The accountability of everybody. The issues surrounding special education are going to be even worse now once we get back in the fall, because now we're going to we need to test all of our students. But to test them, we also have to have professionals who test. With someone with a psychology degree, I don't believe that anyone should be testing our children. That's one thing I do not agree with. We should have specialists in there when we need to have specialists in there to test our students. And as Mrs. Josh said, you know, getting our kids to know, or our students, our early college students to know, hey, we have a job for you if you come to this school, and we'll help you pay your tuition. Tuition is high. Tuition is expensive. People don't want to go to school because of that. School isn't always plausible. We also have to have other programs to get our people into programs and into lifestyles they have to outside of school. So there's a lot there. And then he also mentioned the use of centers and the lack of really the use of centers. I tried that with my students, so I definitely know. I know personally the struggle that we are going to face coming into this school year in the fall, and I'm ready to fight it. I'm ready to get us back where we need to go. The this stimulus money puts our budget at about $300 billion, and I'm hoping to be able to create more jobs within our city, create student jobs within the school to get the students involved so they can figure out what they want to be, to make sure they have these extracurricular activities or these student body governments so that they can go ahead and figure out what they like. You know, they can't know anything if they're not exposed. You know, they've been cooped up in the house and they've been doing things, and we need to make sure they have an outlet. They need to make sure they have things to do. We need our social workers, our mentee workers. We also need all of our support staff, as in counselors, therapists, you know, prevention workers, things of that nature that knows what our children have been through. We need programs to train these people. Those professional developments that our kids are all for are paid for by granting and funding. So they're not optional, but yet our teachers are being told that they're optional and they're not. So, you know, enforcing things like that has to be done coming back into this thing. There's no half stepping or anything. Oh, we're going to lose. We're going to lose our kids to the streets. You know, we're trying to build our community. Destroy it. And it starts in a home, and then it leads to the schools, and it leads to afterwards. And that's all. I believe that's all the questions you ask.
Well, I appreciate all the insight from the candidates here, Tatiana Welch and Josh Burroth, who are both running for the Rochester School Board. 2 weeks from today is the primary. 9 candidates, 3 seats, and you've been hearing them in different phases right here on Connections, so you can be informed voters and understand what the prospective next board members want to do here. When we come back from our only break of the hour, going to hit a number of topics. Tatiana mentioned, for example, some of the data that I think, to be fair, to cite colleague Justin Murphy in the Democrat and Chronicle, for one, pointing to data indicating that the vast majority of teachers in Rochester don't live in Rochester. They live in the suburbs. And Tatiana is saying that when the RTA is surveying its members and they say they didn't feel safe enough to be back in school, she says that, well, most of them were sending their kids to schools in person in the suburbs. And she found a real problem with that. So should that change? Should there be residency requirements? Should there be other efforts to diversify the teaching force that remains majority white? And what do we do about that? I also want to talk about restorative practices and a lot more with the candidates on the other side of this, our only break. Coming up in our second hour, it's all about home growing. Home gardening has exploded during the pandemic, but many growers have found it's hard to find the supplies you need. They sold out pretty fast last year. What about now? How are you doing with that? The experts are joining us to help. And what about indoor plants, which have never been more popular? What works indoors? How do we care for them successfully? We'll talk to you about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. There's been a lot of talk in recent years in the Rochester City School District about restorative practices, reducing the number of suspensions, reducing the presence of uniformed officers, trying to bring students together and circling up, trying to to get them to talk face-to-face when there has been conflict in the hopes of trying to move forward in a way that doesn't always remove students by suspension or expulsion and tries to keep students in the classroom, tries to build relationships. And the question is, should there be more of this? Should we see it in every building? Should we see more attention to it? Or, as some other candidates have suggested, should we see more uniformed officers in schools? Josh, let me start with you. Where do you stand on that? Do restorative practices work?
Restorative practices do work, and I just want to be clear. We should not have more uniforms in the schools. That is not the solution. That's attempting to, essentially criminalize or, criminalize is the right word, our students for behaving like children, right? You have to learn how to behave correctly. And that's not to say you can't have a good relationship with a police officer or a criminal justice worker. That's possible. But the role of restorative practice is so much more appropriate. That's, if you think about this, like five R's in it. So respect, relationship, responsibility, repair, and reintegration. And the idea being that, the student is learning what they did was challenging or wrong for whatever reason and working with another student, if that's the case, on making it better, not just to correct a problem and punish, but to make the behavior not occur because they know better. And it does work, and those schools actually have utilized restorative practice. The suspension rates are down. I think it's, and I say it with a little bit of a smile, it's a no-brainer to do this. Now, the only exception would be is if a school has a different approach in place that's working. And I'm not aware of one that is, but if there were, okay, I'm willing to accept the fact there's other ways to have creative and justice-centered forms of, student learning and student discipline. There's no doubt that, when you look at the numbers, the students who get suspended on a much higher rate are people of color, I'm not saying that, that's the only reason to think that restorative practice is a good idea, but it's also just, pedagogically sound. It's something that I don't think there's not really any leg to stand on to oppose restorative, justice. I guess the only thing you could say, as in terms of the positive for having police officers being paid at a high rate, mind you, to be in the schools, is that some of them individually will develop great relationships, and that's great. But we're paying a lot of money to form those relationships with one or two people, and I don't think that's worth it. If you're going to, talk about relationship building, I think we actually need to have more, social workers and teachers in the school setting to help with those conflict situations and to make sure we actually do it in a way that helps the students, both, one who might be violating, doing something bad, and those who are not. And I think that's really important. And the last thing about restorative justice that we don't often think about is it also includes teachers. The teachers are in this as well. They are not simply referring someone to the vice principal office. They are actually involved in the process of getting, better behavior from the students. And I think that's kind of an overlooked part sometimes. The teachers are involved there as well.
All right, Tatiana, how do you see restorative practices? Do they work?
Absolutely, they work. Absolutely. That goes back to being in a comfortable environment and learning. A student is going to want to come back if all the teacher is doing is harassing them or telling them they can't do anything or they're not worth anything or all they're going to do is get kicked out or get out my classroom. You know what I mean? Even if they're not doing what they're supposed to do, they should not be kicked out of the classroom because they're children. That's what we forget. They are children. How did you feel when you got kicked out of the classroom? I used to get upset. Like, my work was done. Why did it matter? And even if it wasn't done, they would get them for the end of the day. But it was a difference between a teacher who treated me as if I was being disruptive, and that allowed me to be who I was and still participate in class. So it definitely worked. It fosters relationships, like you said. Peer mediation is... that just has to happen. People are forgetting that. That has to happen. That's not something we forget about. You have to sit these kids down and think and talk out their emotions. They don't understand why they just lashed out like that. So let them talk it out. Well, this is really why I lashed out. But what you said to me made me feel like this. Like, my kids talk like that, and everyone always tell me, not to gloat at all, but, you're doing great the way they speak. Like, they're very respectful and they're humble. And I appreciate knowing that because that means I'm doing something right. And I want all of us to remember that we had to peer mediate, whether we liked it or not. And at the end of the day, one of them people that we peer mediated with or we fought or we got into an argument with is one of our best friends now. Restorative practices is less, like you said, SROs. And we can still have centuries and not have SROs, having people that look like them and people that are reinforcing. Like, our centuries just tell us, if you don't go to class, like, you know, get the class, why are you out here? Not all that, oh, you got to, like, you know, a charge. Why am I being charged in school? School's supposed to be a safe zone. How am I safe when there's police officers in here? When I know they're out there killing my friends, my uncle, my dad, my mom, my cousin, my sister. Like, that's a threatening environment, you know? Also, restorative practice includes, that makes it become the after-school program. That's how it comes about as well, because now these kids want to be around. What you going to do for these kids that want to be around? Because school is their safe zone. You know, restorative practice makes it that. A zero-tolerance education system just, it defeats the purpose of social education. You know, it helps resolve conflicts within a person individually and as a group. You never know what that person or that child may have gone through, and I mean person as in staff or teacher. You may not know what those people have gone through, and the emotions that they elicit really weren't towards you. But having a restorative practice means open dialogue, open communication, and that teacher or that child would feel comfortable at the end of the day to come say that. And I'm going to give you an example. When I was at 57th school at YMCA, I had one girl, and I loved her so much. I love all my kids. And she was the coolest kid. She loved to learn, stuff like that. But when she had a bad day, she had a bad day. And I was the blunt of her force. I got bit, I got kicked, I got spit, I got punched, and I ignored her. I had to read a whole book one day with her hanging on my foot, hanging on my leg. I had to help a kid with homework while she was biting my arm or something. Whatever she was biting, I can't remember exactly per se. But the fact that I had open communication with her, and she felt that she was comfortable come to me and apologize, I had to say, you know, I apologize. This is why I did that. This is how I felt. I felt he was ignoring me, da, 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 and I was ignoring her because of her behavior. So, you know, so we are having a dialogue now. That opens the way for dialogue, no matter what. Being suspended for me made me not want to come to school when I wasn't suspended. Because why? All you're going to do is kick me out again. And I was a person who did their work and went to another teacher's class and helped them do some. Because why am I sitting here if I've already done my work, or if I felt I learned this, or you're not teaching me anything? Kids need to still talk. They're not going to care if you don't care. The teachers that didn't care about me learning, I didn't do anything. I brought my work to school. I was done in 15 minutes before class was over, and I left. That's not a good behavior. I left because I didn't feel cared about. I didn't feel, you know, I apologize. So I'm going to end it right there because I was going a little personal there. But it's that restorative practice is a personal thing for me. And I actually, it's a public, what is it, school foundations of public education, I believe it is. I follow them a lot. They do something with Oakland, and it works. And it's other places, like three other states, that has these programs, and it works, and it shows these abilities that it could work here. The background, the dynamic, the social economic status mimics a little bit, and we can put these things in force. And I'm a researcher, so I'm always down for new things or learning things that my kids say, hey, we don't have this. Do you know about this? And if I don't, I'll go out and find out. So restorative practices, yes.
Tatiana and Josh, let me ask you then about teaching and what you can do as members of the school board to make some changes there. First of all, Tatiana, two questions. Should there be a residency requirement? I mean, you talked about the fact that the majority of teachers in Rochester don't live in Rochester. They live in the suburbs. Can you force a change with that? And can you find a different way to approach the ongoing problem of a lack of diversity in teaching? Are there more successful avenues that the board, that the district could travel to get this changed?
Yes. I absolutely feel that there should be a residency requirement. There, you don't live where we live. You don't go through what we go through. You hear about what we go through. We are being re-traumatized every day by hearing our friend or our family member or our relative or someone we knew was killed or shot by either a community member or a police or anyone. You know, these are traumas, you know, these kids are going through. And anybody of any color that doesn't live in our city and isn't facing the trauma our kids are facing shouldn't be in their faces teaching them about something they don't know nothing about. And what I mean that is their feelings, their emotions, these curriculums that we should be having now. And I say that with all the sincerity because a lot of my history that I learned and how I learned about me is from the most beautiful white lady I've ever met. I love her to death. Dr. Janie Hines, she teaches at Brockport, and she teaches slavery courses and history courses, but they're in an English way. It's not as if she's teaching us something. She's giving us the facts and telling us to express how we felt about the facts. And then going around making us have, like, a test to remember the facts. That is teaching, not telling us how you feel about something. You understand? So it's not about race. It's about where you're from. So, yes, we can have white teachers, but are they from where we're from? Are they living where we live? Are they going through what we go through? That's what it's about when it comes to the requirements of educating in the city. Are we having these avenues to add more people? We have paraprofessionals. Are we adding more programs to certify them and get them onto the next level to become teachers after they've been paras for so long? We don't have these avenues. Where are they? You know, we have to build those avenues. You were saying adding. Can you say the second part that you said, please?
Well, I wonder if there's a different way of approaching teacher diversity, because for years we've heard this district and many other districts say that they care about it, that they're, you know, that they're going to try to build more relationships with historically black colleges or build a pipeline, and it hasn't resulted in all that much change.
Right. So we have, again, it stems with getting our kids interested in teaching. Who wants to teach when this teacher always telling me I ain't nothing? I don't want to be that teacher. You understand? So we have to make sure our kids and our young adults and our adolescents, because 6 to 25 is an adolescence by scientific fact, and our older generation and our mid-generation to want to teach. They don't want to teach anymore. So we have to get them back to this community learning, community-based schooling in order for them to want to be there, get parents involved in these classes. We're not even allowed to walk into the classroom because in the RTA's contract, we have to give the school 24-hour notice. That's blasphemous. What are you doing with my child? What are you teaching my child? I can't walk in and check on them. What if my child had a bad day? My child is very emotional, and he expresses himself. But he also makes growling noises sometimes, and I have to calm him and talk to him. But do you know that? My kid's teacher does know that, because I have open communication with my teachers. But just the fact of not having that shows that just not being able to do anything is because of the lack of knowledge. So, yes, that's how I feel. I get emotional when I talk about it, because I'm hurt. I'm sad. I'm hurt. Our kids and our district, I don't see anything. I don't see any program that these kids have to even get the HBCUs to look. Where's our dance classes? Where's our karate classes? Where's our wrestling? Where's our soccer? Where's our basketball? We have a few basketball teams and football teams. We should be having them in middle school. Our drama classes, our chess club. How are they supposed to know what they like if they don't have access to it? Our Arabic classes, our Spanish classes, our Hebrew classes, our Swahili classes. We have to have programs for these HBCUs to want to come here, or these people from HBCUs that are teaching to want to come here. We can't say, oh, I got this for you. Rochester right now, our reputation sucks. So why would they want to come here? The worst thing, that's one thing a relative of mine always said, why did you come back to Rochester? Because I know what's here, and I want to be here. This is where I want to begin, because this is where I know my heart is. This is where I'm born. I've been around. I've been through the schools. I know how teachers are. My ninth grade year, and you could ask anybody that was in that class that remembers, I was kicked out my math class because I corrected the teacher, and she was wrong about something. It was a negative and something like that. Me and my best friend always joke about it. And she kicked me out of the class for the rest of the year. At the end of the year, I was the only one, including the smartest girl in class, to pass her test. So it's things like that is why I wanted to come back here, because I'm an educator. I've always been an educator. I started out teaching at Georgia State University's Upward Bound program in 11th grade. When I was there as a student, I knew most of the SAT words. They hired me as a TA. So this is who I am, what I do. So I want to help other teachers learn how to care, how to approach our kids, and to make sure we're having teachers that look like them more, the same percentages. If it's 12%, of others, it should be 12% of other teachers. 82% of black and Latino, it should be 82% of black and Latino. If it's 26% Muslim and Arabic speaking cultures there should be Arabic and speaking cultures in every school. And yes, there should be programs in every school. You asked about programs being in every school.
Josh, can you pick it up from there? Residency requirements for teachers and a way for the district to address diversity in teaching ranks.
Okay, am I going to get equal time?
Go for it.
Okay. Yes, I do think teachers should, in fact, live in the school district. I think it's a loss if they do not. I think that it's a question of, you know, whether or not, you know, they're there now or not. They're not. About 80% of them do not live in the school district. And I think that they do miss out on the experiences that, you know, are had by our children. But it's not just, you know, living in the district. It's actually where in, you know, the city you live. You know, the environments in the city vary dramatically. I think that's something we need to consider. I talked to some teachers about this because, you know, this is something we've been talking about for a while. And, you know, I asked them, okay, well, why don't you live in the, you know, in the school, in the district? And they said, well, some said they didn't want to. Fair enough. I understand that. But some said they couldn't actually take advantage of the enhancements or the incentives that were given them by the district. There were some major hoops to jump through. If we're serious about getting our teachers to live in the district, there's two things we need to do. One, we need to hire people who already live in the city and say, okay, we want you to come here for your your employment and not to go someplace else. And so we need to get people who are residents already. And for those who are not, with the, you know, work with them and say, well, what will it take to get you in here? How can we do this? I don't think we can legally force them to do so. And if we can, I'm not sure that's going to be something we can do in the short term anyhow. But by God, in the next 5 or 10 years, we sure should be moving a lot closer towards having a lot more teachers living in the district for sure. What was the second half of that?
Well, on the subject of building a pipeline or a more successful plan to get diversity in teaching ranks.
Right. So I think one of the big things, and Tatiana touched on it, is, you know, we can try to attract teachers who we want, so teachers of color, teachers who might represent different cultures, things like that. But if we don't have an environment that's conducive for their growth and learning, then why would they come? And if they do come, they'll just leave again because other districts will hire them. So we need to make sure that we change our environment in such a way that if you come in, you're not going to get laid off every summer and maybe get hired back at the end of the summer for a fall term. And that's one of the things I find particularly egregious about how we go about with our staffing. I mean, the teachers don't know if they'll be teaching in a year. And they don't know until sometimes the day's notice. We need to change that. So our new teachers who, you know, they're mostly bipartisan teachers. That, you know, if we're trying to hire them on, they get hired on, and then they're the first ones, the last ones to be hired, so the first ones to be fired. And that's something that we need to work with the RTA on, because that's a contract issue. And a lot of this does come down to the RTA, because, you know, I think Tatiana's right. You know, some of the restrictions that are placed upon various policies, such as, you know, having notice to go to the visitor school, are in place, but they don't need to be in place. And I don't know why they're in the contract in the first place. But this is a conversation to have with members of the RTA to make that happen. Because we can't just unilaterally say everyone must live in the district by next year. There's got to be a process. And I would think that, you know, this is, it's reasonable to think that we could do this over 5 years. And that's just to be real. Now, in terms of really recruiting BIPOC teachers, I really do think, and I think there's some buy-in from the administration right now, that we need to develop a pipeline of our current students to become, you know, teachers. We pay for it, and then they come back, and they teach with us because they'll know the land, they'll know the people, and they will have investment, and we'll have the benefit of their lived experience. Because the best teachers for any student is whoever's most like them, and that's why we have, you know, peer mentors. They're living it. We have younger teachers. They're younger. They're closer to the student's age. We have students who look, you know, teachers who look like their students, and that does matter. That doesn't mean you have to be of a particular race or gender, but it matters. You know, it has an effect. And that's something that we do need to recognize. So, yes, we absolutely need to have more teachers of color. We also have to make sure we give them a good environment to work in. And most importantly, we need to have a way of promoting those who are in the district so they have long-term reason to stay. And I'm thinking primarily about the paraprofessionals and the teachers' aides who have proven they can work with our students, who are really passionate and really committed. Okay, they want to be teachers. Let's help them become teachers. Let's have a program that will pay for their education. You know, this is not rocket science. And that, you know, bringing in our students back, retaining our, you know, our non-teaching staff members who could become teaching staff members, that's really going to change around how our teaching staff looks. And I think that, frankly, is probably one of the more important things we need to get going on, because our attempts to just go to HBCUs has failed. You know, we can't compete with the really rich districts who pay so much more. We don't compete with them. And then even if we get them, They don't get tenure, so they get laid off every summer. And that's a terrible work environment. We need to do better than that.
All right, so let me, as we wrap the program, early voting starts this weekend. The primary election day is 2 weeks from today. Josh, a website that you would want people to learn more about you? If you've got it, go ahead. What is it?
Well, I actually do not have a website per se. I have a Facebook page, and it's facebook.com. Josh Barth, RCSD School Board. I can also, if you see any literature, and I shouldn't say this, but my home phone number's on there, so feel free, you'll get me.
Tatiana Welch, where can people learn more about you? Are you there, Tatiana?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, no, Tatiana.
I'm here.
Yeah.
I also have a Facebook page, and all my information, including my phone number and my website, is on there. Tatiana Welch for RCSD School Board Commissioner.
Tatiana, thank you for taking the time for the program. Nice talking to you.
Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity and the airtime. You guys be safe and blessed. God bless.
Very good. And Josh, thank you to you as well, sir.
Thank you so much. I had a great time. I love the conversation. I love that, you know, Tatiana and I would talk about these things. I have to give a special shout out to Megan Mack. She did a great job behind the scenes.
they all do great work behind the scenes. I love that. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Tatiana. More connections coming up.